did what everybody else in the community did. I kept my damn mouth shut because this was the rule in this country. And your mothers and fathers and your cousins and your aunts and your uncles all participated in this. All the American people participated in this disgraceful period that we went through. And I participated in it too by keeping my mouth shut.
There were more than enough arch villains to go around, but the name usually associated with America's 1950s nightmare is McCarthyism. In fact, our post-World War II anti-communist hysteria did not begin or end with Senator Joe McCarthy, nor did he personally orchestrate every case of political persecution of the period. For the popular radio personality John Henry Falk, the villain was Aware Incorporated, a private group that took on the role of virtual judge and executioner of alleged dissidents within the radio and television industry. Falk recounted his harrowing story in a speech entitled, "What Happens to a Democratic Society When Fear is Rampant?" Hi, I'm Lucia Chappell, and this is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio.
I would kick Aware in the teeth, and I would absolutely make the wittiest, most devastating statements against them. Always when I was in the bathroom with the door shut and I shaved.
At around the same time as Falk was challenging the fear that gripped the country, Pacifica Radio was also feeling the squeeze on its own freedom of speech. Even after being investigated by the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, the FBI, and other government agencies, Pacifica continued to offer a home to legions of blacklisted artists and thinkers throughout the McCarthy era and well into the 1960s, when many of them were still considered too hot to handle by the mainstream media. So, when John Henry Falk spoke at the University of Texas, Austin on November 6, 1969, it was only natural for his stirring talk to find its way to Pacifica's airwaves and into the Pacifica radio archives. Couched in his trademark folksy Texas humor, Falk's insights demonstrate once again the value of a critical, alternative interpretation of history as he compares the terrible times of McCarthyism to the Nixon administration in power at the time of his speech, and as we see unavoidable parallels in the present political scene.
I was born and raised out in South Austin, Texas, Travis County, and when I was about 12 years old, I was playing in the backyard with a boy named Boots Cooper, and Mama said, "Johnny, there's a chicken snake out in the hen house. Would you get a hoe and go out there and kill it?" Boots and I went out there at the hen house, and the chicken snake, I don't know whether you ever saw one in the hen's nest or not, but this swings its head, and it's a frightful-looking sight, licking out its tongue and hissing. Got us right jumpy. We stayed about three hoe handle lengths away from it. And even the poor old Dominecker hens were closer to it than we were. And we were challenging each other. "Go on, hell, it ain't gonna hurt you. Get up there and get at it." And finally, Mama came out there and said, "Law have mercy, give me that hoe." And she took the hoe and knocked the chicken snake's head off with it. And then said, "Great goodness, don't you all know that a chicken snake is harmless? A chicken snake won't hurt you." And Boots Cooper made an observation that has stayed with me a long time. He said, "Yes, ma'am, I know a chicken snake won't hurt you, Miss Falk, but they can scare you so bad you'll hurt yourself." And this has a point, a relevance to what I want to say to y'all tonight. What happens to a democratic society such as ours, such as the University of Texas campus, or to the American society as a whole, when fear gets rampant, when intimidation and opprobrium becomes the law of the day, what happens to our society? And that's what I propose to discuss with y'all tonight. I devoutly hope there are those here tonight who will take exception to things that I say. Nothing is more boring than to get up and run my mouth and presume that everyone is agreeing with me. I hope that you will take notes and take exception to anything that I say that doesn't meet with your approval. or that raises questions in your mind. Now, many of you are in the age group that don't recall a period back yonder. I have to indulge in a little bit of personal history now. I've already confessed I taught at the University of Texas, which is dismal enough. But then I come from old fighting pioneer stock, like us Texans do, and I went into the Army after they finally caught up with me back in 44. And being of that military quality that Texas produces so lavishly, I shot rapidly up through the ranks from buck private all the way up to PFC and kind of lodged there for the duration. I was on one of the most ferocious battlefronts, and I didn't come here to brag about my military prowess and my background. I let General Abrams and General Westmoreland do that, but I just want to mention it to stay in company with them. I was stationed at that frighteningly, devastatingly hazardous front called Camp Swift, Texas, down Bastrop County. The whole 2 years that I was in the Army, 18 miles from Mama's back door. Now, don't laugh too soon, because it's a matter of military history and fact that during that period that I was there, neither Hitler nor Hirohito invaded Bastrop County. At any rate, got out of the Army in 46, and I'd like to say that because Homer P. Rainey had been fired by the Board of Regents, I refused to return to the University of Texas as a matter of principle. Well, it wasn't that at all. CBS offered me a hell of a lot more money than even full professors make here at the University of Texas, so I went to New York and became what is euphemistically called, and what the press agents at CBS called, a folk humorist on CBS, and started chopping in tall cotton. First thing I knew, I was making a hell of a lot of money, living very high, and had me a huge apartment there with four bathrooms, which was 3.5 more than I was raised with out in South Austin, and was terribly impressed with myself and absolutely enthusiastic from the word go over my dynamic potentials as a humorist and a folk say man. In the early 50s, or around by 1950, I was well established and things were going terribly well my way. I had a network show on radio, I had a television show, and television had just come in by this time, so I was doing terribly well. And let me again apologize for being very personal, but it's necessary for me to get this point across. But during that period, there swept across the land a terrible wave of repression and fear we've come to call McCarthyism. It was named for Senator Joe McCarthy, who was constantly finding communists everywhere, in the State Department, in the Administrative Department, in the Executive Department. Everybody was a communist to him, and he was making hay. And over America, there fell a vast pall of silence. And you all would really be astonished today if you could realize how profound this silence was that fell. It touched every area of American lives. Universities fired professors. Librarians kicked out librarians and books. Churches threw out their ministers. All based in this terrible climate of fear that gripped America. And running alongside of McCarthy, and incidentally it's a pretty unfair charge to call it the McCarthy period, because Senator McCarthy was not either the originator nor the cause of this period of repression and silence that fell on America. Senator McCarthy was the exploiter of it. He simply took advantage of it. But the man that took advantage of it with equal enthusiasm and with equal opportunism was a man by the name of Richard Nixon, a kind of an unknown from out here in California, a congressman, that suddenly emerged as a great pronouncer of the Democratic Party being a party of treason. And for the first time, they entered the American language. Literally, for the first time in my entire life, or within the memory of anyone, really, in the country, they entered the American language the word treason and traitor. And we heard pronounced in the big campaign of 1952, 20 years of treason we'd been treated to by the Democrats. Roosevelt and Truman had been parties to this great treason against the people. And as I say, a hysteria swept over this country that was breathtaking. Well, I was chopping in tall cotton there in New York. Running along with this, these charges of treason and the kind of silence, it touched every area of our lives, was the proliferation through our country of vigilante groups, self-appointed citizens groups, who began to pronounce on the patriotism of their neighbors and began to function as policemen on what happened in America and who was admissible as a citizen and who wasn't. And it was a pretty shocking period that swept over this country, and thank God most of you are too young to remember that, because it was a grisly period where the leading citizens and the beloved and the greatly respected Dwight Eisenhower went along with it. Dick Nixon was one of the great exploiters of this period. He was the chief red hunter in the country in his day. He was constantly finding them, and he used his campaign motto in 1952, "We have been subjected to 20 years of treason in the United States." With the proliferation of these vigilante groups, there grew up in the business that I was in, namely radio and television, a group, vigilante group, called Aware Incorporated. It functioned in Hollywood and New York. You never heard of it, because most people didn't hear of it. It was a secret kind of organization, secret in the sense that its work was all quiet and undercover. Aware Incorporated had red, white, and blue with stationery with eagles grabbing at American flags on it, and blazoned across the top of their stationery was an organization to combat the communist conspiracy in the United States in the radio and television industry. Well, there's two presumptions necessary in order to take Aware seriously. The first presumption is that there was a communist conspiracy in the radio and television industry, and number two, that Aware was the proper and authorized organization to combat it. I accepted neither one, but as I say to you, I was living pretty high off the hog again and doing terribly well, much better than any Falk had ever done anywhere in any endeavor he'd ever taken part in. I was vain as a damn turkey gobbler. I love for folks to come ask me for my autograph at the studio doors, you know, and I love to be at all the big openings on Broadway and have Jinx Falkenberg or Tex McCreary say, "And here comes John Henry Falk, our favorite Texan." All this went to my head. However, I was very bothered, because we had just fought a war against totalitarianism, against Hitler. And Mr. Hitler had built his reputation and his power on the Anti-Comintern Pact. He and Mr. Mussolini and Hirohito signed it. And the United States, many voices in the United States and very powerful voices, had supported Mr. Hitler, had approved of his, he was going to cleanse the world of this terrible threat of communism. And Hitler had built a situation or brought about a situation in Germany where the entire German people reacted like Pavlovian dogs to the word Jew. Jew, you could do anything you wanted to them. If you just branded a man with his great-great-grandma having been a Jew, you could go down and tear up his shop, and they did. You could go and drag him out, drag his family out, and do anything you want to, and the German people would say, "Heil Hitler." It's a glorious thing. They began to react automatically to this word Jew. And I saw happening in my own society, the American society, literally the same word, the same thing in terms of the matter of saying commie. He's a commie. Well, that's a commie. Or it's a communist organization or a pro-commie organization. We began to react like Pavlovian dogs. And it was not only distressing to me, but pretty painful, really, because I was living so high off the low. Now, Aware, in order to combat the communist conspiracy, did not go to the Justice Department and turn over the names of persons that they felt were conspirators and the evidence of their conspiracy, as you would think one would, or as the law would indicate we should. But the way Aware did it was once a month publish a bulletin listing the names of performers in Hollywood and New York, singers, dancers, actors, newscasters, directors, writers, anyone connected with the entertainment industry. They'd list the names and some transgression that these persons had done in the past. Hell, maybe 10 years before. Made no difference. 20 years before. They'd signed a petition. They'd marched in a parade. They had entertained at what Aware, the vigilante group Aware, considered a left-wing or a pro-communist group, and so they were listed. Now, these names weren't sent, as I say, to the Justice Department. These names were sent to the employers of those performers, to the network executives, to the advertising agencies, and to the sponsors. And those persons that were so named were never called in and never said, well, listen, is this true or false? Did you sign a petition in 1947 or 1945? Did you speak at Madison Square Garden at a Russian war relief thing? They weren't called in. They were simply fired. They were dismissed. Never told why. Consequently, they never had any appeal because there was no one to go to. And the list of these performers in Hollywood and New York, and if I could name them off to you, you'd recognize the names because many of them were nationally known figures, were simply washed out. They became unemployable. They were on what we call a blacklist because Aware would threaten the corporations, threaten the networks with the charge of you're soft on communism if they employed them. Or this product, Barden's Milk, or Kraft Cheese, or for God's sakes, any of the big sponsors. If they continued to employ these persons, they were told that we'll have to publish to the public that you are employing subversives and contributing to the international conspiracy, communist conspiracy. And of course, if you're interested in selling soap or toothpaste or cheese, you sure in hell don't want to get in a fight. All you want to do is sell your cheese and your product. And so it was much easier to fire these people, and that was what was happening. Well, this began to kind of gnaw at me, but you never were supposed to discuss it. No one was supposed to discuss this. You weren't supposed to ever attack anything in government. You weren't supposed to criticize McCarthy. You weren't supposed to criticize the House Un-American Activities Committee. And God save the rout, you were certainly never supposed to say anything about J. Edgar Hoover. You're supposed to kind of genuflect and cross yourself and keep quiet. This was the atmosphere that prevailed in this country. Just think. Just 15 short years ago, it was totally the dominant atmosphere. No politician, no patriot rose up and said a damn thing. They accepted it. And certainly in the entertainment industry, where you could be blacklisted without any charge, everybody fell silent. And one day, I'd attack McCarthy because, see, as I told y'all about my military background, I'm a pretty rough character, and I come from that old fighting Texas pioneer stock like Lyndon does. We get somebody else to do it if we can. But at any rate, we don't allow nobody to talk tacky. And I would fight McCarthy. I would tear him to ribbons. I would kick Aware in the teeth, and I would absolutely make the wittiest, most devastating statements against them. Always when I was in the bathroom with the door shut and I was shaving. I did what everybody else in the community did. I kept my damn mouth shut because this was the rule in this country, and your mothers and fathers and your cousins and your aunts and your uncles all participated in this. All the American people participated in this disgraceful period that we went through. And I participated in it too by keeping my mouth shut. One time I ran into, one afternoon down there at Toot Shores, ran into a young man, a fellow that had been an enormously successful writer. God, he'd made a fortune of money for radio and television. And he was in rags. He told me his wife and children were living up in Connecticut with his his in-laws and that he was trying to get a job as a shoe salesman. And I said, what the crawling hell has happened to you? He said, I'm blacklisted. I said, what'd you do? He said, I have no idea. Some petition I signed, something I said 10 years ago, I'm on the blacklist. I said, why don't you take a go and get that straightened out? He said, who do you go to? I can't be touched. I'm an untouchable. Well, that night I was telling my business manager, we were having dinner, and I said, this is the most shocking thing I've ever heard of. Here's one of the most talented and productive and creative young men that I knew. And for the last year and a half, he says he can't even find a job. He's selling shoes now. What the hell has happened to our society? The business manager said, Johnny, you've been asleep. Says, this is the rule in America today. Nobody says anything, and you keep your damn mouth shut. It's a shakedown racket that AWARE is running. The networks, the agencies, and the sponsors are all paying these guys off, all undercover. Nobody knows about it. They pay them large sums to tell them who they can employ and who they can't. And all AWARE has to do is put your name on the list, and you're a dead duck, so keep quiet. Well, the next night, I was having dinner with a very, very distinguished commentator that if you all watch the news, you probably saw him tonight, and his wife and some friends of mine at CBS. And I got to sounding off. I said, what the hell kind of people have we become here that we all fall silent and are intimidated into silence and watching justice rampant on both sides? These poor devils getting blacklisted with no kind of appeal at all. What do we call ourselves? And damned if the hostess didn't ask me to leave. She said, we don't discuss things like that, Johnny. We don't even want that discussion going on in our house. Word will get out. And sure enough, the next day, by 2 o'clock, I was called in there at CBS and said, listen, Johnny, we hear you're rocking the boat. You can get in trouble that way, honey. Getting a lot of trouble. Better keep your mouth shut. Well, I was groaning and moaning over it. Well, we had a union in our profession called American Federation of Radio and Television Actors. American Federation of Radio and Television Actors' sole purpose for existing was to see that the members of the union got a fair shake with the networks. The only reason. I had to belong to it because it was a closed shop. You had to belong in order to perform on radio, network radio and television. So I said, well, the only purpose of a damn union is to look after the membership's interest, and for God's sakes, if they're all getting this treatment, getting blacklisted, and the blacklist by that time had gotten long as all get out. Y'all have no idea how many people that you hear and see every day on radio and television today literally couldn't find work and couldn't be told why. They were working in delicatessens and in Macy's and shoe stores. I checked in on the union and found out that the board of directors of our union were the board of directors of AWARE. They'd completely taken the union over. I'd never been to a union meeting. Consequently, anyone who stood up at a union meeting and complained about blacklisting or complained about the injustices going on got on a blacklist, and this was commonly known, and so you didn't go to union meetings. The two biggest locals were in Hollywood and New York, and the silence was absolute total. They ran the union, and they ran AWARE. Well, I was sitting out on Fire Island. I had a home out on Fire Island, summer home out on Fire Island, with Orson Bean. Y'all might have seen him, he's a comedian. And Charles Collingwood, who's a CBS commentator, he was my newsman on my morning show then, a network television show I had. And we got talking about this one night, drinking. Not smoking nothing, but just drinking. But we was higher than all get out. And that old whiskey will get you that way, children, and I want y'all to stay off of it. But at any rate, we got terribly high, and I got to making speeches about America wasn't founded by cowards and it won't be saved by cowards and all this nonsense you go through when you're sufficiently drunk. And that we were shameful participants in an ugly and vicious system, and we didn't deserve what we deserved anything we got, rather, for seeing this going on around us and keeping their mouths shut. And Collingwood and Bean were saying, amen, this is good. That's right, we feel the same way. And so we signed a pledge. I said, let's run against those stinkpots in the damn union, and let's take over the union and make a damn blacklisting illegal. And they said, that's fine. I picked up a phone, called old Gary Moore, and I called an actress named Faye Emerson. These all names, y'all, a little bit for y'all. But anyway, called a bunch of, they said, that's fine, Johnny. You willing to? Well, hell, we are too, because we, see, everybody loathed to wear. Nobody did anything about it. They kept quiet. So we signed up, and then I sobered up. God almighty, next thing I knew, I'd run in against these vicious people, you know, and proclaiming things and scared to death. But we ran, and we swept into office with the biggest vote that was ever accorded anyone in our entire union in Hollywood, New York, and were given the mandate to wipe out blacklisting. Got in office 2 weeks. None of us had ever been to a damn union meeting before, and we're suddenly the officers of the union. But we got in there and point come in, we started writing all kind of resolution, we're gonna stop blacklisting. But 2 weeks later, the House Un-American Activities Committee, the most notorious and sickening organization, even had to change its name to stay in business, that this country ever let loose, published a great statement that the New York local of AFTRA had been taken over by red infiltrators. And this scared the jumping hell is in New York Times. See, they released this kind of crap in New York Times. And scared all our bunch to death. Then the next day, here comes a wire with a bulletin out, secretly circulated to all the employers, saying, John Henry Falk, Orson Bean, Charles Collingwood, the men that engineered this desperate and vicious act in New York, say they're not communists, but let's have a look at them. And then they listed tacky things that old Charles Collingwood had said and done, like he didn't like a wear, or he didn't. Yeah, honest to God, they charged him with that. Charged him with attacking the House Un-American Activities Committee, as idiotic as it might sound, but this was a serious charge there. And they got on, Bean had done a satire against McCarthy, and then they got down to me and Falk, John Henry Falk, five things that I'd done ugly and subversive. Three of them were totally false, so that was easy, but two of them were true. One of them, and I just cite this example, this was circulated, now mind you, in Hollywood and New York to all the employers, the sponsors, the networks, and the agencies in a climate of absolute fear. Said, John Henry Falk is reputed officially to have attended a dinner and entertained at a dinner in the Astor Hotel on May the 7th, 1947, under the sponsorship of a pro-communist organization, and in partnership with an unrepudiated communist entertainer named Pete Seeger. And so I checked back, because I knew Pete pretty well, I checked back, and sure enough, I had done this. This was 10 years later, see, they brought this charge. What they didn't mention in this bulletin, they had all this communist and communist and communist crap, what they didn't mention in the bulletin was that this was a birthday dinner celebration for the United Nations Security Council, sponsored by 87 different national organizations, including the American Bar Association, the National YMCA, the National YWCA, and that the co-chairman of it was Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt and Mr. Harold Ickes, and that the principal speaker at the occasion at the Astor Hotel was the then Secretary of State, Mr. Edward Stettinius, and that it was broadcast full network over CBS, and that I was sent by CBS to be there. None of that was mentioned. Just Pete Seeger, communist, communist, communist. I cite that and take time to so you all be acquainted with the kind of thing that could scare the hell out of America at that time.